podcast is brought to you by
Get ready for the bold, juicy flavor of the Aloha Burger at Big Kahuna Burger. We buy a flame-grilled 100% kahuna beef with zesty pineapple slices, crisp lettuce, ripe red tomato, and our signature kahuna sauce on a freshly baked bun. One bite of a Big Kahuna Burger, and you'll think, that is a tasty burger. And now for a limited time, get a free order of coconut shrimp with any combo meal purchase, only at participating Big Kahuna Burgers. At Big Kahuna, we do burgers right. Burgers so tasty, they're dino-freaking-mite. So come on in to Big Kahuna, because once you taste our burgers, you wish you'd come in sooner. Big Kahuna Burger, located off Highway 61. Hawaiian shirts optional.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I ain't saying it's right, but you saying a foot massage don't mean nothing. I'm saying it does. And look, I've given a million ladies a million foot massages, and they all meant something. We act like they don't, but they do. I mean, that's what's so fucking cool about it. There's a sensuous thing going on where you know, you don't talk about it, but you know it, she knows it. Fucking Marcellus knew it. And Antoine should have fucking better known better. I mean, that's his fucking wife, man. They think they have no sense of humor about this shit.
Welcome all you inglorious bastards to the very first episode of Character Study, the new Season 3 monthly series dedicated to exploring the psychological makeup, motivations, and complexities of the characters that reside in the world of Pulp Fiction. I'm your host, the Reverend Scott Kay, and on this month's episode, we will be focusing our examination on the charismatic, heroin-loving hitman, Vincent Vega, to see what makes him tick. Joining me on this exploration is friend of the show and host of the Caged and Coppola Connections podcast and co-host of the Getting to Foyer podcast, Mr. Petros Patsilivas. Welcome back, Mr. Patsilivas. M.A. Tarantino, be with you always.
And always with you, Scott. Thank you so much for having me back for... I've kind of lost count how many times I've darkened your doorstep.
It's under 10, but it's getting close. However, I did look at my list for this year. And barring some weird episode that I decided to come up with, this is your one and only appearance. Your one and only stop by the fucking church.
Well, you got to start off on a high note. And then it's all going to be downhill from here, guys. I do apologize.
I start off the new year and I'll talk to you again next year when we see what kind of turmoil the world's in as we kick into 2025. Now, any New Year's resolutions as we kick into 2024? And anything new with your two podcast series? I do believe you've just recently wrapped season or series two, as you blokes over there in the UK call them, of the Getting to Foe You podcast. And I know you've been on a little hiatus for Mr. Cage's podcast.
Yeah, so I am coming back with Caged In at some point. I'll probably be doing my usual cageuary stuff. So I'll be kind of having a look at the year previous in Cage's output and like what is happening in the future. Obviously do a deep dive on his what he said about retiring and stuff like that, and then Getting to Foe You. We're kind of in that mid-season break, but we will have our season two wrap up coming very soon, and a bonus episode about something that is related to Willem Dafoe, but is not necessarily a film. So that could be a video game, a short film, a documentary that he lends his voice to. Something that is tertiary to the main output. And we're taking a bit of not a massively extended hiatus between seasons two and three, but like we're taking like a winter break because we're like we don't want to be recording when it's like ridiculously freezing and we kind of want to be in the best spirits. So, but season three, every guest is locked in, every film is locked in. Mm. If people listen to the final episode of season two, there'll be a nice little Easter egg at the end of that episode, what we'll be kicking off season three with. That's a little tease for people to go listen to that episode right until the end, because you won't know unless you listen right until the end. If people listen to the season one finale episode, you would have heard the Green Goblin's laugh. It's something similar to that.
Oh, very
it's like
nice.
A kind of audio clue that if you know, you'll know what film it is. And I think this one, for me, yeah, it was very, very obvious.
Is it the unzipping of his pants to let us know it's Antichrist?
Antichrist has been. So,
oh, no, that's right. You did. That's right. Damn it.
Yeah.
All right. So he will not be unzipping his fly at the end of that episode. That is intentional because I got a text the other day from our good friend Ian Harries, and I was on your show, and I was also on your co-host's. I mean, I was on your show last year. I was on your co-host show earlier in the fall, and then I also did the amazing Boondock Saints with you on Getting to FOU. And because Ian Harries had decided to watch The Retirement Plan, which was the show I spoke on with Daryl on his Cage Rage podcast, he decided to go on it. And he said, is there every time that you don't talk about Defoe's dick or jerking off in the first 5 minutes? And I said, hey, what are you going to do? And I said, da-dong. And now I wanted to make sure if he's listening. There you go. We got some Defoe dick in this episode as well for you, Ian Harries. The rest of you are like, what the fuck is happening? It's a very niche Easter egg for one person. So
it's the extended Defoe getting Defoe universe now. I love it. I love that Defoe's dick is like the Nick Fury of podcasts at the moment.
Well, the funny thing is that happened on my show before you guys even were, you had announced going to be doing Defoe over a year ago. And then you guys, whatever happened, it went on hiatus for almost a year before he did it. So it just was like on my Inglourious Bastards of season one we talked about it. And it just like, I mean, just like his dick, it has extended.
Well, that was like
another timeline.
You mentioning it was like the end of Iron Man. Do you know what I mean? Nick Fury saying, I'm putting a team together. You didn't know it. You're doing a slow tease for a podcast that you didn't know that was actually going to ever come out. So thank you very much for that, Scott.
Well, if you know, maybe I'll just devote my rest of my podcast when I'm done after Tarantino raps that will maybe just be nothing but Defoe dong or just dong in general, just movie dongs.
Movie dick, yeah, amazing.
Oh my goodness. Now, since we are here to talk about the amazing Vincent Vega, what is your personal connection to the character? What was your initial impression of him when he came on screen? And how, or if, that has changed over time?
Well, I think when I first saw the film, like I kind of had that baggage of John Travolta being in films that like I very much enjoyed. Like he's kind of an omnipresent presence throughout my kind of childhood. I think watching Grease all the time and the PG cut of Saturday Night Fever, he was kind of just there. And I remember being, I don't know, having memories of the film Michael. It's not very good, is it? It's John Travolta was the angel.
Yes. But you're a big fan of Look Who's Talking. That's look what people, all of them. The Look Who's Not Talking.
Look Who's Talking. I like those movies, like as a kid. So like he was, as I said, like an omnipresent presence. And then I obviously hadn't really had seen his like more adult material, like the film. Yeah, like I knew Saturday Night Fever, but I knew the PG cut. So I didn't know him as this like, do you know what I mean, disco dancing rapist that he actually was in that movie. Like, or like I hadn't seen Blowout. So to kind of answer that final question first about like how my opinion of him changed, like Blowout is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I know that it's one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies and is like the exact reason why he cast John Travolta as Vincent Vega. And I just remember the first time watching it, like thinking, like going through different emotions, being like, this guy is really cool, to like, fuck me, like he's a, do you know what I mean, he's a heroin like addict, but still is like swaggering and cool with it. He's like a weird functioning heroin.
He's a functioning heroin addict.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah, which is like
100%, which is weird to say, but he is.
And I think immediately that first kind of introduction to him, there's like an air of mystery of like, who is this guy? What has he been doing? Like, obviously he's talking about Europe and stuff like that. You're thrown in at the deep end on both characters, and there is an intrigue and mystique to him. So, I just thought it was like ultra cool. And like, I remember like the fate of the character being, I think I would have watched this when I was way too young the first time. So like, I think like, I was a bit like, wait a second, why is that guy back? Like, didn't we see him get shot after he took a shit? Like, but like, yeah, I loved the character. Like, I do think like from, and it was interesting watching it again for this podcast record, was like, I think he's my favorite character in the film. Because he is, I don't know, he's got the, yeah, he's got the swagger and the charisma. Like, it's obviously the performance from John Travolta, but like, he just gets some of the best stuff to do. Like, and I think like, he kind of is the linchpin. And I kind of flippantly said this on Letterboxd in my review, but I was like, if you put the film in chronological order, it is just basically the story of Vincent Vega, like, escaping death multiple times and then getting shot after taking a shit. Like, and it's like a shit saved his life and a shit ended his life. And yes, it is like this, almost like this great kind of ironic bittersweet joke. If you put the film back into like the correct order, he is like the kind of through line, really. It's like, this man's toilet habits are like basically his downfall. Do you know what I mean? He goes for a piss, and like, Mia Wallace is basically like ODing on heroin. He goes for a shit and like manages to escape being held at gunpoint, and like probably turns the tables on that whole situation, because obviously it gives them to the upper hand, because the kind of Mexican standoff is then very much in Jules and Vince's favor. And then him taking a shit in Butcher's apartment and not taking his gun is what very much is his downfall. So, his is a tale of piss and shit.
Yes. And if told in linear fashion, he has a better character arc than in the way it's told. Because he goes, which we'll get into, he goes from kind of a douchebaggy guy to lovable guy for what he did for Mia Wallace. And then, oh man, that's sad that he's dead. To, hey, he's a really nice guy. To, what a fucking asshole. He probably deserved to be dead. It's kind of the arc he gets in Pulp Fiction. It's kind of like, well, we liked him at the beginning, but it's like, he has like that stuntman Mike arc where you're like, oh, I hope he kills all these people. And then you're like, yeah, he probably deserved being killed. You know, so.
Jimmy, we need to raid your linen closet. I need blankets, I need comforters, I need quilts, I need bedspreads. Thicker the better, the darker the better. No whites. Can't use them. We need to camouflage the interior of the car. We're going to line the front seat and the back seat and the floorboards with quilts and blankets. So if a cop stops us and starts sticking his big snout in the car, the subterfuge won't last. But at a glance, the car will appear to be normal. Jimmy, lead the way. Boys, get to work.
Please would be nice.
Come again?
I said a please would be nice.
Get it straight, Buster. I'm not here to say please. I'm here to tell you what to do. And if self-preservation is an instinct you possess, you better fucking do it, and do it quick. I'm here to help. If my help's not appreciated, lots of luck, gentlemen.
No, 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 Mr. Wolf. It ain't like that. Your help is definitely appreciated.
Mr. Wolf, listen. I don't mean disrespect, okay? I respect you. I just don't like people barking orders at me, that's all.
If I'm curt with you, it's because time is a factor. I think fast, I talk fast. And I need you guys to act fast if you want to get out of this. So, pretty please, with sugar on top, clean the fucking car.
Don't be looking at me like that, all right? I can feel your look.
And now, the AI psychological evaluation.
Now, in order for us to better understand the psychological makeup of Vincent Vega, I turned to the power of AI, not Allen Iverson, but artificial intelligence, and asked it to perform a psychological evaluation on Mr. Vincent Vega. And here are the results of that evaluation. Vincent Vega exhibits traits of antisocial personality disorder. He lacks empathy and concerns for others, as evidenced by his willingness to kill for money without remorse. Vincent also displays a complete disregard for rules and laws, considering his choice of profession is that of a hitman. Vincent shows signs of impulsivity and irresponsibility. He frequently takes risks, like consuming heroin before an important job, and irresponsibly forgets to put his weapon on safe, resulting in the accidental killing of Marvin. During interactions with others, Vincent demonstrates arrogance and hostility. He feels superior to those around him and bullies perceived weaker individuals like Butch. This suggests narcissistic tendencies and hostility stemming from inner insecurities. Vincent appears desensitized to violence and death. His years as a hitman seem to have numbed him emotionally as he kills without feeling and is able to discuss death casually over dinner. This lack of empathy is a hallmark of antisocial personality disorder. In summary, Vincent Vega appears to be a character grappling with the dichotomy of his profession and personal vulnerabilities. He exhibits a complex personality marked by a blend of confidence and impulsivity. Vincent displays many of the classic traits of antisocial personality disorder, as well as narcissism. His profession as a hitman suggests a comfort with risk and a detachment from conventional moral boundaries, as well as an ability to suppress empathy while showing an inability to connect emotionally with others. Vincent's interactions, particularly with Mia Wallace, reveal an ability to navigate social situations, but also highlight his susceptibility to distraction and desire. His nonchalant attitude and lack of long-term planning suggest a focus on the present moment. However, his underlying vulnerabilities, such as his unease during the date with Mia, hint at deeper emotional complexities. AI people, that saved me hours. That saved me hours and money of having to try to find somebody. That shit was crazy. So, use AI for all its powers. Mr. Patsilvis, what do you think of the psychological evaluation that was pretty spot on? It's a pretty strong one of our man Vincent. Anything you disagree with in that result?
I don't disagree with any of it, but at the same time, it does obviously strip out the fact that, like, what movie making can do, because, like, he very much is still a very cool character within the confines of the film, whilst having all of those kind of, like, if you kind of look at him clinically, yeah, he is fucked. And that's what the joy is of Tarantino films, right? Is you take these flawed characters and you're very much put in the driving seat with them, and you get to almost, I don't know, love them despite them being bad people. And, like, Vincent Vega is very much the kind of archetype of that.
Vincent Vega's not the first anti-hero type of person. No. It just was, this film helped to start usher in that era that would bring in stuff like Breaking Bad and all the other Mad Men, all these other characters that we've gotten that before, when Hollywood first started, it was cut and dry. It's black and white, right? You're good or you're evil, right? You wear the white suit or you wear the black hat. Like, that's who you are. You're good or you're evil. There is no middle ground. You're either the man of justice or the man of evil. And doesn't matter what's happened to make you evil, you should know better and you're evil. And no matter what the good guy does, even if it seems like it might be a little questionable, he must be doing it for the side of good. And what I like about this moral ambiguity and why I think these characters resonate is because us as human beings have these same kind of problems. Like, I don't think any of us want to sit down and get a psychological evaluation like that, you know, because we don't really want to know what kind of fucking turd burgers we truly might be and kind of psychos we are. We can fire in a heartbeat if people really knew the inner workings of some of us sometimes. So it's fun to do that, and which I'm going to do the rest of the series, is to have these evaluations, and in a little bit we'll come up with his diagnosis that they came up with. But the characters that were, I mean, like I said before, Scorsese, the 70s really started to work with these. Like, the Kurtz is, and as they always say, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. You know, it's all Travis perspective. Travis Bickle. So yeah. All these kind of people, the reason they're so fresh characters and you fell in love with Vincent as did I, is we can relate to these people. They feel grounded in reality, as opposed to, I'm a huge Superman fan. Superman's not a real person. It's not what a human being is. You know, like, it's just always good all the time. You know, sometimes you do need to get dirty to get things done. It's, you know, sometimes it's that kind of moral grounds that we all deal with in our own lives. So I think these characters that not just Tarantino, but other, especially in the 90s, brought back, is people that we could identify with, because us as the audience also saw ourselves in them. We've had moments where we really do champion the good, and then sometimes we fall on some of our base desires and we're pieces of shit sometimes, you know? There are things we've said or done that sometimes you look back and go, God damn it. But in the moment, you're like, fuck it, I don't give a shit. You know, you've lost your bearing. And then you look back, you know, years down the road, and you go, man, that was a really fucking dumb thing to do. I really wish I hadn't said that or done that. And these characters feel more like that, as opposed to the sanitized versions of characters we had in Hollywood in the early days. Even, let's be honest, even in the 80s, our action heroes were always doing right, but they're blowing up and killing things at willy-nilly step. But we're always like,
oh, yeah,
USA! It's just like, okay.
The civilian deaths in those movies are just kind of like
unbelievable.
Yeah. Like, yeah, but they got the bad guy.
Exactly, exactly. Collateral damage, okay. Freedom won, baby!
You ever seen that show Cops? I was watching it one time, and there was this cop on. He was talking about this gunfight he had in the hallway with this guy, right? And he just unloaded on this guy, and nothing happened. He didn't hit nothing. Okay, it was just him and this guy. I mean, you know, It's freaky, but it happens.
Look, you want to play blind man, go walk with a shepherd. But me, my eyes are wide fucking open.
What the fuck does that mean?
I mean, that's it for me. From here on in, you can consider my ass retired.
Jesus Christ.
Don't blaspheme.
God damn it,
I said, don't do that.
Hey, you know, fuck, you're fucking freaking out on us.
Look, I'm telling Marcellus today. I'm through.
But why don't you tell him at the same time why?
Don't worry, I will.
Yeah, and I'll bet you $10,000 he lasts his ass off.
I don't give a damn if he does.
Marvin, what do you make of all this?
Man, I don't even have an opinion.
Well, you gotta have an opinion. I mean, do you think that God came down from heaven and stopped... Oh!
What the fuck's happening?
Oh, man, I shot Marvin in the face.
Why the fuck did you do that?
Well, I didn't mean to do it. It was an accident.
Oh, man, I seen some crazy-ass shit in my time, but this...
Chill out, man. I told you it was an accident. You probably... You went over a bump or something.
Hey, the car ain't hit no motherfucking bump.
Hey, look, man, I didn't mean to shoot the son of a bitch. The gun went off. I don't know why.
Well, look at this fucking mess, man. We're on a city street in broad daylight here.
Believe it, man.
Well, believe it now, motherfucker. We gotta get this car off the road. You know, cops tend to know this shit like you're driving a
just
car pissed in fucking blood.
Just take it to a friendly place, that's all.
This is the Valley, Vincent. Marcellus ain't got no friendly places in the Valley.
But you'll save my fucking town, man.
Shit.
But now, let's find out who Vincent Vega is. We're going to explore a little Vincent's background, some of his history, and his arc, as we kind of discussed a little bit in the film. Now, as you're going to hear next week, if you tune into the new series here on the Church called Inglourious Blue Balls, myself and my new co-host Sean Wheeler are going to discuss the very first thing he ever talked about, the very first announcement, that being the Vega Brothers, aka Double V Vega, as it is somehow earned that name over time. That movie would have dealt with his relationship with Vic Vega. Those of you who don't know Vic Vega, he is the psychotic, dancing, ear-cutting off, shooting people if there's an alarm goes off, brother, Mr. Blonde from Reservoir Dogs. Now, I remember sitting in the theater, having already seen Reservoir Dogs on VHS in the summer, springtime, on my journey into the Tarantino world. And I remember when they said Vincent, when, you know, Mia Wasik, Vincent Vega, like the light bulb went off, like, wait a minute. Is he related to Vic Vega? Like, are we saying there's a brothers? So that was the first, like, semi-hard on. Like, I was like, what? There's a world together? I was like, oh, this is awesome. But what do we think his relationship with Vic is? Because in the film, I feel like if this was going to be, if they had come out with that movie first, that would have been the prequel. And I have a feeling that something happens along the lines of Bud and Bill's relationship where it becomes a fractured relationship. Because, now look, this is all hearsay because obviously the movies were written, and then he thought about this as an idea. He just thought it was cool to have these two people as characters. I'm sure he didn't flesh it out in his mind, because neither mentions the other one, but he does write in the way that they are written their stories, where there is the possibility that neither one would actually know what's happened to the other one if they separate from this supposed rendezvous together in Amsterdam, where I feel Vincent or Vic is in prison by the time Vincent gets out. Comes back from Amsterdam.
Yeah.
He's only in town 5-6 days, I think it is, like less than a week before he is killed. So his death probably wouldn't reach Vic until after he gets out of prison. And Vic's only out of prison. I mean, both these guys, talk about bathroom things. These guys get back from wherever they are and they're not alive long afterwards. Vincent comes back from Amsterdam, dead. Vic got out of prison pretty soon later, dead. So the Vega brothers, you want to talk about fucking curse from birth.
Well, yeah. And like, you think about like, you think about Joe Cabot, like, he didn't really do a good job of that. You would have thought that would have been one of the first things he would have said to him, that his brother's dead. Do you know what I mean? Because they're both LA set. Like,
I'm sure there was a letter or something passing, so I'm sure he knows. You know, again, that's the cool thing. They could have really, he could have tightened up whatever happened and it would have made sense why we don't talk about him when we were there. But again, it's the minutia. We don't need to know a whole lot about Vic Vega. We just need to know how he knows the people so that when he is shot by Mr. Orange, we know Mr. Orange is missing information. Mr. Orange doesn't know that Mr. Blonde is very close to the two gentlemen that are accusing him of being the fucking what's called. You know what I mean? So we don't need to know about his dead brother, you know, who hadn't been written yet. You know that brother that died that you don't know about because I haven't written him yet? I want to let you know he's dead.
And how do we not know that Mr. Brown... is Tarantino's character isn't just Jimmy from He's in LA. Do you know what I mean? He needs to get some new sheets.
Yeah. I mean, and his wife was supposed to be in it. Bonnie was supposed to be the snake charmer they're talking about. Anywho, we're not here to talk about restaurant dogs, but Vic Vega does. So I think that there's a strained relationship for sure. I think the movie would have figured that out. However, we do discuss there's a possibility of a novel. There has been rumors of that. We'll listen to the episode, just like you said. There's a little Easter egg. Listen to the episode, see what we feel about that. I think that the two of them, obviously, something happens in this story that we'll never maybe know, where it answers why they're not very close. But I feel it's a very Bud and Bill type of relationship where something happened of probably when he goes over to visit him that really fractures the relationship and separates them, where they're just not very close. And again, in the days of the 90s, we don't have Facebook and all this stuff. Like, you know, you talk to friends and family on the phone. That was, or wrote them letters.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Even email wasn't all that big just yet. So, you know, staying in touch, especially when you're living overseas, it would have been different. LA to, I know it's like a 8-hour difference from Amsterdam to LA. Or maybe 9, depending.
Well, and we don't even know that, obviously, there would have been a film with the two of them in it, whether they would have been in on good terms.
Exactly, to start then, with.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, we can only think, like, because I think Tarantino has obviously speculated about it would have been, like, a weekend, essentially, when Vic went over to Amsterdam. And we don't know if, obviously, it's Vincent, like, I've come here to do a job for Marcellus Wallace, look after this bar, kind of work in this club. And then Vic is like the agent of chaos that kind of like fucks it all up. Do you know what I mean? And then it's like, they're already fractious beforehand. Things just get worse. It's Vincent Vega just trying to keep his brother out of shit. And then like they leave on bad terms. Do you know what I mean? Like, so
yeah.
He probably, if anything, that, yeah, we probably, he probably doesn't talk about his brother because he's probably like, fuck that guy. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, he killed a couple of sex workers and like, do you know what I mean? Got him in some heat with like some Amsterdam, like, dodgy characters and stuff like that. Like, yeah, put the heat on him. Marcellus Wallace's like muscle have got to come and like, do you know what I mean? Like, even more muscle have got to come in and sort stuff out. So it's like, yeah.
Or does Vincent sort it out? Because my next two things I want to ask you about is, why do we think Vincent sent there? And just by how Marcellus greets Vincent in this film, how highly regarded do we think he is by Marcellus? Because there's some clues. As Jules is telling him the story, obviously, of the feet and Rocky Horror, that his wife is somewhat of a honey trap, as I said in my very first episode. And obviously, Vincent doesn't know what he's about to get himself into. But Jules, or I should say, Marcellus trusts him very, very much to be out of town, to watch his wife, and to not think that anything is going to happen along the lines of Tony Rocky Horror. He also obviously sends him to Amsterdam for something that's very important, then brings him back. And the first thing he does, he sends him on this very important job to get this case. I think he's even higher up on the arc than Jules is. I think he's actually more looked after by Marcellus than Jules. So why do we think he was sent to Amsterdam? And maybe the story we don't know about is why he is so highly regarded by Marcellus. Maybe he does something over in Amsterdam that really shows him that this is the guy I can fucking trust. Because he does say, immediately, like, yeah, because the way he hugs him, he's so happy to see him. You know, like Marcellus holds Vincent so highly.
Well, I think there's either two scenarios why he sent him to do this job. One is either like a favor. Vince has got like the heat on him and he's like, you know what? To kind of let things die down, I've got this connection in Amsterdam. You can go over there for 3 years. Or he's like, I've got a really, or the other one is, I've got a really important job. I need a guy I trust. So, and I think it's probably that. Like, we send enough gangster movies, do you know what I mean? Like, they kind of get their number one guy, or they get like the guy who maybe, yeah, is having a bit of trouble or whatever. Or maybe he's done like a Michael Corleone. Like, he did a job. He kind of took out some really heavy guys for Marcellus Wallace. And he's like, don't worry, I've got you a nice little, like, I've got a thing sorted out. You're gonna shoot the police commissioner or whatever. Do you know what I mean? You're gonna do like a big job for me, but as a kind of thank you and get you out of Dodge, I've got this job lined up in Amsterdam for you. You get to kind of have a little jaunt around Europe as well. It's not just, do you know what I mean? Because it sounds like it's not just work. Like, he has time to kind of go to Paris and, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And there's probably other places he went. Do you know what I mean? Like, So it's not all just work, work, work. Like, so yeah, I think he is kind of, and the fact he's not driving the car and Jules is, that normally shows, I find like that shows rank.
Especially in the mafia. Like,
or like, yeah,
usually
like
the person driving
gangs.
The car is somebody, but if you are someone of importance, you get driven around. As Jay-Z eventually says, I don't buy the cars, I get driven in them, kind of thing. So once you realize you're a baller, you get driven. But yeah, the other thing someone could say though, someone could say, well, you know what, he's been in Amsterdam for a while, maybe he doesn't have a license anymore. However, he gets his car out too, so he does have a license. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, when you go to pick up the person on the date, you're the one driving. But when you're the one going around the job, someone else is driving, you're the fucking main guy. Yeah, and I think that's part of the case. So whatever the backstory that we don't have on Vincent, whatever he has done, he has put himself into a position where Marcellus trusts him greatly. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that Jules is afraid of him by any stretch of imagination, because that's not who Jules is. But even Jules shows him a little respect when they're arguing about getting blood in the towel. He kind of pauses. Look, I respect you. You know what I mean? Like, there's like he may even know that in the hierarchy of Marcellus's people, he's held pretty high. No one else was asked to take me out. No one else was trusted to take me out. But our boy Vincent was, and that almost went bad. That almost went, as you say, tits up for him as well.
Well, yeah, and as we know as well, like, there was no Tony Rocky Horror incident, like, that involving Mia Wallace. Because, like, the only time I ever met him was when he, like, the only time he's ever touched me is when he shook my hand at my wedding. So it
maybe. However, my caveat to that is how both Jules and Paul at the bar, when they ask him, have you met Mia yet? They both know there's something, and even she says, when you scamps get together, it's like a sewing circle. There's some rumors swirling about Mia that'll be fun when I get into her episode. We'll find out. I don't know if Mia's as you know, innocent as we like to think that she
squeaky
is.
Squeaky clean, yeah.
You know? So, I mean, the date does somewhat prove that maybe she's not as innocent as she claims. Speaking of those people, let's talk a little bit about the relationships that he forms in this movie with the four characters specifically. With Jules. Jules and him have worked together before. There's a comfortability. They are catching up in that car. One, at this point, there's no way whoever's listening to this podcast is a hater of Tarantino. If you're on season 3, you like Tarantino, just fucking admit to it, all right? So anyways, but if, for the haters who are out there, the great thing that I love about his scripts is his subtext, his comfortability with writing. He knows his characters prior to, so we're being thrown into meeting them. A lot of movies, we have to start off, get to know the person, get a backstory, eventually move along. And it's like, oh, I don't give a fuck. We know nothing about these two guys, but by the way that they are carrying on, we know everything we need to know. The way they're talking, they've known each other for a while. There's a comfortability. They're getting caught up. Like, before we find out about, well, because he's telling us, he was in Amsterdam, we're getting caught up. Jules is catching up with Vincent, who he's worked with before. They're not best of friends, but they've worked together before. And he's getting caught up on this whole deal. And that's the kind of cool banter that we get in the beginning of that scene.
Yeah.
Is they're catching up. Two buddies who'd worked together before, hadn't seen each other in a while, they're catching up. And that's what's happening. And I love that about it. But I don't know that it goes much past that. I mean, I think they build a stronger relationship, but this relationship is so brief and so quick, because if Jules does go off on his merry way, kung fu-esque like ways, then the moment of that bar, that's it. After the day of the bar, by the time the date happens, Jules is gone. Jules has left.
Well, yeah, we know that because it's Martin, the guy who works at the bar, is basically doing the Jules role, isn't it? It's him and Vincent walking down the corridor at the boxing match.
Yep.
He's kind of like being like, oh, I don't have to polish glasses anymore. Like, it's like Marcellus Wallace is like stepping up to the plate, bad
boy.
You've
been upgraded, yep.
Yeah. Like, oh, finally, I'm out of the bar. He's like, throws down the tea towel. Do you know what I mean? Yep. Throws down the cloth. Like, that's it. My days are done. Some other schmuck's got to do that now.
But yeah, so they have a very brief interaction. But I mean, look, the two of them together are electric. Their banter back and forth is electric. And some of the best scenes are with the two of them talking. They're just delicious. There's just so much fun about it.
That kind of, like, because obviously you have that, like, pre-title sequence with Honey Bunny and
Pumpkin.
But I think, like, what really pulls you into the film is just those two talking. Because for a lot of people, and, like, even by the time I'd, like, seen this film, like, obviously other films have probably, like, aped it and, like, done it. It felt really refreshing to just kind of be like, oh, it's just two guys talking. Like, and obviously they are like, they're dodgy characters, but they're like, do you know what I mean? They're talking about like, yeah, they're just talking about Le Big Mac. And like, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like what happens like in Europe and stuff like that. And like the difference between like, you can get a beer in McDonald's and stuff like that. And it's like, and it's just so, so exciting and captivating and like really fresh. And it's like, I don't know, it feels like even movies try and do it now, like we see it, like, but even rewatching this, it's like, it's just so, like, that stuff is so great, and you kind of instantly drawn into those characters. And yeah, even if they hadn't worked together, like, you could imagine just Jules had heard about Vince as well, like, that's kind of like, do you know what I mean? He's like, oh yeah, like, so tell me about this trip, like, do you know what I mean? It's like, and it speaks to that thing of being like just a part of this kind of criminal organization, where it's just like, even if they hadn't worked together before, they're a part of this club, so it's like they kind of get the repartee straight away. And like, yeah, like you say, when it kind of, as things progress, and like, you see that Vince probably is a bit more, senior rank when he's like answering back to Winston Wolfe and stuff like that. But like, and yeah, I just like that kind of interchange in like dialogue between them, like when they're arguing down that hallway. It's just so intriguing as well, because like, what are they going to do? And there's that just like amazing kind of tracking shot through the hall, and like, but breaking each other's balls as well. When he's
but that's how you know they know each other. You know, that's know that they have somewhat of repartee, because if usually two people are, you know, if they don't know each other, no one wants to back down. You know, and that's what Joe Cavett talks about sometimes. You know, when they're doing the colors, you don't know him, he doesn't know you, no one wants to back down. You know what I mean? So this is how we know that these two know each other. And it's, the crazy thing is, what, they're together 6 hours maybe total. By the time they go do this whole job, clean out the car, get some breakfast, and return with the case, it's 6 hours, and that's it. But it feels like they've known each other for 1,000 years, which is a great. Not to the ability of the actors and the writing from Tarantino just fucking knocked it out of the park. And it's also how we know that him and Marcellus, the more you watch the film, the more times you watch it, the more you start to see the little, as I say, subtext of each character. Certain things Marcellus is allowing this man to do states that he is thought of a lot higher than anyone else is. Oh, yeah. He's taking out Mia. He's asking about Mia because obviously he's just got back into town. The first thing he's asked to do besides his job is, hey, when this job is over, one day this week, I'm headed out of town. I would like you to take care of my wife and watch her. And maybe he's babysitting her. Like, think about it. Like, there's a lot of subtext. I mean, we could just infer on things, and maybe it's wrong, but there's something to be said that maybe even Marcellus is a little worried that when the cat's away, the dog will play. And he's making sure that Marcellus is going to, or not Marcellus, he's making sure Vincent's the man who's going to watch him. I always love, like, take her out. Like, the thing about that, like, it's a funny line, but for Jules to make that the step tells you some things that Jules knows that Vincent doesn't, that even though when he's asking her questions, why I always still think the great thing about the Mia character, the great thing about this is we don't know. We can only just infer what some of these characters might be knowing. It's just like, as she said, no one really knows why Tony Rockhart got thrown out of that balcony. We have an idea what it could have been. You know, but we don't know. I mean, because, you know, Mia, the way she's portrayed by Uma is so enamoring that we just go, oh, see, she's a princess. No, she's not. We'll get into that in a second. But Marcellus clearly trusts him more than anybody else. It's why, now, for those of you who don't know, the reason Vince gets shot, that may not even be his gun. That may be Marcellus's gun that he left out there, or it's his. And the reason, it took me a while, sometimes I'm like, how does he not hear the door open? How does he not hear the door close? How does he not hear all that in the outside the bathroom? Because the person coming back that he was waiting for was Marcellus. Marcellus and Vince were at his apartment sitting. The reason Marcellus gets hit across the street, he went to get donuts for them and was bringing them back. Yeah. The reason Vincent thought nothing of it, taking a shit, he thought Marcellus was back. There's no way he thought what's-his-name was going to come walking through the fucking door in the morning. There's no fucking way. He let his guard down because he knew that Marcellus was on his way back with donuts. That's why he gets shot. That's why he doesn't know. It's because when he opens the door, that's why he's got that surprise in his face. He's expecting a bald black man to have donuts on the counter, not some fucking white dude who we called fucking Beluga a couple days earlier, fucking standing there with a fucking Uzi pointing at him.
Well, we don't know as well. He's deep into that book as well.
True.
Like, do you know what I mean?
But that just shows you that who did he take with him? Who did Marcellus go with?
Yeah,
he went fucking Vincent. So Vincent's a lot higher up in the organization. It would have been cool to see that movie come to fruition because we could have seen maybe some of that stuff that we have to infer and try to guess of why he is so high.
I had never thought about that fact that it was Marcellus who was there with him. Like, that makes total sense.
It took me a couple of viewings to go, oh, duh. I mean, like, why else would he hit him? Like, Marcellus is just walking around some fucking shithole area to get donuts. Yeah. The guy, the day or two earlier, he's up in the fucking hills. He's got a fucking lavish pool. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't need to be slumming it at this moment, you know? So that's where the two are. That's why they're there.
And it kind of takes away that whole thing of just like it being like a freak coincidence.
Exactly. He's not a freak coincidence. Like, exactly.
It happened. Yeah. He's in the area for a specific reason. You would imagine Vince would have had a gun on him. He just didn't have time to draw it.
Yeah. Like I said, because he doesn't. Yeah. He's not assuming someone's in there. If it's told a different way, if Marcellus isn't with him and the way Tarantino writes, the surprise would have been that we didn't know the bathroom door was closed. He makes some noise, thinks he's free and clear, and he gets shot through the fucking door, and he dies. And then we go, oh, shit, he is in there. That's the other flip that you would do. But how do you make it so that that's not how it happens, and you want the story to go that way? Simple. Marcellus and him went, because we're like, wow, man, that's it for Vincent. And you're kind of like bummed out at that moment. And then he's driving, he's singing flowers on the, all of a sudden he looks up and there's a big black man holding doors. Yeah. All hell breaks loose. You're like, well, where did he come out of nowhere? And that's why.
Yeah, because he's probably thinking like, he probably said to him like, hey man, I'm going out to get the donuts. And he's like, oh, I'm just going to quickly take a shit whilst you're gone. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? And he's quickly gone, oh, he's forgot his wallet or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's come back, boom. Yeah, yeah, that's, I'm learning. Every day's a school day, baby.
I'm not saying you should shit with the door open. I'm just saying if you are doing some heinous stuff and you have to take a shit on a job, you shit with the door open or else you end up like fucking Vincent Vega.
And reading's bad, ladies and gentlemen. You shouldn't read books, okay? Knowledge is bad. That's what we learned from Vince Vega.
Well, speaking of bad, also, our buddy also knows Lance really well. Obviously, Lance is his main dealer when he was in town. When he comes back, he sees Lance. What I love about their interaction is we've all been there where we say something and we didn't realize who was going to offend the person we say it to. So I'm not going to say who I said this to or who the person was. But recently, I was recording with somebody and I said something about DJs and how they're stupid. And then later on in the recording, the person said, and I took it out of the the episode because it wasn't important, but it also made me look a fucking dick. So I was trying to save my own face, but I'll say it here. I said, you know, DJs, they're stupid. You know, some guy will push them buttons. Ooh. And then like 20 minutes go by, we talk about it. And oh yeah, by the way, I'm going to be DJing my own birthday. I'm thinking, oh, I was like, Jesus Christ. I just fucking took a shit on DJs and here this kid, I'm like, person's going to go DJ. He's like, you know, I don't know if he did it all the time, but for birthday, knew somebody he's going to go DJ his own birthday party. I thought, ah, oh, what a fucking prick I am. But that's the Lance thing. Which one's that? The one with all the shit in their face? That was my fucking, that's my fucking Vincent Lance moment. I was like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so we're pretty thinking he knows Lance.
Knows Lance real well.
He knows him well, but obviously Jody is, they've got married in the last, they've met and got married in the last three years
or so, yeah.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely. And somehow he moves into circles where he also knows the people who know Marcellus or what also, you know, because he obviously deals with people in the Marcellus world as well, that being Lance, that, or at least he knows of him. He knows of Marcellus because you know who this bitch is? No, he goes, it's Marcellus Wallace's wife. And it's like, as soon as he says that name, it's like, that's Don Corleone's wife. You're in the know, you're in the fucking know. That's Tony Soprano's wife. It's like, oh, all right, we got to do something about this.
What you get from like Vince, like Vincent Vega as well, is he is like the kind of like playable character in like a GTA game. Do you know what I mean? Yes, like, because he is like the kind of lackey for like the big guy. Like, he's kind of going out on these jobs. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, Lance is definitely someone you get missions from on a GTA game. Do you know what I mean?
100%. Especially from GTA 5. I always thought Michael in that game was like one of the guys who'd be working for Marcellus. And then, I apologize. I forget the black character's name. I haven't played. I mean, I played the game.
Franklin.
I played the game ad nauseum when it was out, but I haven't played in a couple years because it just, it was bad. I would kill a lot of people. But like Franklin feels like he's in the Jackie Brown world. He would know like Ordell, right? Like, because that's the level where he is. Oh, and then the other guy, I forget his name too, but he is fucking, he knows Zed and Maynard. Like, he knows Zed and Maynard.
Yeah.
That's the level they fall down the line in Grand Theft Auto 5. So,
yeah, 100%.
Now I want to play that game as Vincent Vega.
But you find out where, yeah, is it, where does Vincent Jules lives in Oakland. And
oh, my man in Inglewood, our man from Amsterdam. He said he called him Amsterdam, so he still didn't have a home yet. So he was just kind of back. When he calls him in, he goes, "Hey, Jules, our man from Inglewood. Vincent, our man from Amsterdam."
No, because Winston Wolf at the end, he says, like, "Where can I drop you off?" And they say where they live.
Oh, that's right.
And it's like, I'm in Inglewood, and I'm in, like, I can't remember where Vince says. And then he says, I see in your future.
Future cab ride.
Cab ride. Get out of the sticks, gentlemen.
So fucking good. So fucking good. Yeah, so him and Lance, they know each other. They've been buddies. And that brings us to Miss Mia Wallace. Obviously, their flirtatious relationship happens. I will get into more of Mia and the date that happens. There's a whole episode from Pulp Reflections based on it later in the year. We'll talk more about Mia and her relationship with Marcellus in a couple months. But we'll just focus on Vincent. Ooh, honey fucking trap that he did not know. I don't know when it happens because he is so high on heroin when he first shows up. Doesn't see it. He's still in a fog, in a haze. Yeah. It's not until he finally gets the courage up to ask her. He's a little like almost like schoolboy shy about the Tony Rocky Horror rumor when he starts to get personal with her. And then the dancing, he was like, no. But once they win, obviously when they get back to the house after winning the dance, there's that, you feel like, you're like, oh, everyone watching the film, even now you go, these two are fucking. Like, you just know, like, everyone, it doesn't matter. You can be anywhere. You can see two people and the way they look at you, you go, oh, they're fucking later or in a few minutes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can feel the vibes. Yeah, and there was vibes, strong vibes. Here's like, uh-oh, danger, Will Robinson.
That's why he's going to the toilet for a pep talk. You're going to have a drink. You're going to have it real quick and you're getting out of it.
Now, do we think he jerked off while he's in there? And here's why I asked that. He's in there a long time. Now, I get it's a film and we got to give some space for her to get the OT, but he is in there a long time. And by the time he comes out, she's been on the ground for at least a couple of strong minutes. And he comes out a lot less energy, a lot more chin. I didn't do heroin because she's got the heroin in her. He's let up out in his coat. I can't prove it, but I feel like he might have just got one out, got it out of the way so he could get home without danger because he knew he was in trouble.
It's a very valid point.
This does show the way that he's in there talking. He obviously has something going there for him and Mia in that moment. But his discussion about loyalty is probably why Marcellus chooses him all the time. Even in the face of adversity, he is going to leave. He has no idea she's fucking OD'd. She's not OD'd. He's walking the fuck out. That's his whole plan. Like I said, Vincent goes backwards when we watch this film. His trajectory is like, hey, oh, shithead. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's like, there is like almost like a, there is a version of this that is like a kind of like crime caper comedy.
Yes.
Because it is just constantly him being like that situation. It's like, it can be definitely played for more, it could have been played for more laughs of like him like being like, I'm in this situation, like, I need to get out of it. And it's like, wah, wah, wah. Just when you think you're like out of the cold water, it just gets even more freezing. Do you know what I mean? Like, as he kind of comes out and she's OD'd. Yeah, I think his arc is very much a comedic one in a weird way, because it's just like jumping these hurdles. Do you know what I mean? It's like the fucking Odyssey, and then he just gets taken out by Butch.
I mean, at the end of the day, it is about his shit habits. It's really about heroin, because heroin makes you constipated, so he has to sit there, read the book to help himself shit. If he doesn't do heroin, none of these are problems, because don't have to worry about the balloons being baggies, or the baggies being balloons. Don't have to worry about all these things that lead to this fucking night of chaos. However, Mia was the honey trap, and he did survive. Do you think when he walks out and sees her ODing, he goes, it would have been so much easier if I just fucked her and tried to hide that, that she may be dead now. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to die now. I could have at least had sex with her. At least that way the death would have been worth it. Like, she's like, I did the right thing. I'm leaving. This bitch is fucking OD'd. And if I don't fucking find a way to save her life, I'm fucking dead anyways, you know? It's one of those, like, God damn, I thought they were doing the right thing. And at the end of the day, I'm dead no matter what.
Well, he's probably thinking, why the fuck did I have that wank? Do you know what I mean? It's like, if I didn't have cracked one off the wrist.
Look, the Church of Tarantino is going to go out with a fan theory that I think the time in which he's in there after we last see him He jerks one out real quick, gets it out of the way, because he is fucking in a whole different headspace when he comes back. It's like, all right, me, you know, it's like, he is in post-nut clarity. He's like, I got to go.
Yeah, that's what he's thinking.
I think it's what happened. I think he just said, real quick, done, we're out, all right.
Yeah, and that's the thing. This is the 90s as well, so he's having like a memory wank. Do you know what I mean? He's not got a mobile phone where he could be looking up some porn either.
No,
he's like got to close them eyes and think about some titties he's seen once.
Oh man, oh fantastic!
You see, this is a moral test of oneself whether or not you can maintain loyalty, because being loyal is very important. So. You're gonna go out there, you're gonna say goodnight, I've had a very lovely evening. Walk out the door, get in the car, go home, jerk off, and that's all you're gonna do.
All right, Mia. So listen, I gotta go, all right? Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, fuck me. Fuck me! Oh, come on, girl. We're getting out of here. We got to walk now.
Before I jump into our clinical diagnosis, I got to talk a little bit about some of the behaviors we get from Vincent that are kind of up and down in some major scenes. The first one, case retrieval, where we go and after we've had a great reunion ball busting and learning about each other and talking to one another between him and Jules, they retrieve the case. And we'll get more of this in Jules's character study, but Vincent takes a back seat to Jules. I think for two reasons. Vincent's playing the we don't know who this guy is quiet type. There's a great Simpsons episode where like the Yakuza fight the mafia in his front yard for something, and there's a short Asian guy in a white suit stands there, and he's not doing anything, and Marge forces Homer to go inside first. He goes, oh, I want to see what the little guy in the white suit was going to do, because he knew something was going to happen, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of like what Vincent is. He's the guy we don't know what he's going to do, and he's standing behind us, and he's quiet. And then Jules does his thing. Very professional, Vincent is in this moment. Clearly, some things happen, though. So we'll keep it as if this is one cycle, because obviously the first time we see it, we jump. And then we go to the Mia Wallace date, and we circle back later at the end of the film with the Bonnie situation. But if we can combine the two moments together, where obviously, because that is also two, there's like two cold opens in the film. We get the diner, we get our freaking credits, we learn about them, and then we jump, and then we get into our three stories, and then we realize that those three stories all come together, those two moments come together in the final story. But when we get in the car, and we're having this discussion, and obviously, clearly, Vincent thinks Jules out of his fucking mind that God came down and stopped the world. Because he's, I mean, in his mind, he's like, dude, we're fucking hit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if God's going to do some miracles, I don't know where on the fucking list to first. You know, I don't know if we go to the top of the list where we don't get shot. You know, again, I'm not, whatever people want to believe, miracle or not, I don't care. But I kind of side a little bit with, like, Vincent. Like, this is really bad shooting. I've seen some people who can't shoot, being in my military career. Couldn't hit you if you stood in front of him. But when we watch the scene of him shooting Marvin in the face, his finger's in the trigger well. There are fan theories out there that it was intentional. Now, the reaction we get kind of says otherwise. But when he's sitting there, and his finger is there. Like, what are your feelings on this? Is this an intentional move by fucking Vincent? Or is he just completely careless and just goes with his character that sometimes, like, even though in the scene he's very professional, doesn't say anything, he plays the silent type, does his part, what he has to do, keeps it together, where Jules is almost falling apart at the seams, like, maybe we can have this discussion in the car and not in a jail cell. Like, he's in his faculties, but then when we get in the car, he gets flustered, and then he ends up shooting Marvin in the face. But some feel, fingers on the trigger, not surprised that he shot him in the face. Because he does say to Mr. Wolf later, gun just went off. But it didn't just go off, did it? Your thoughts?
I think he was just being a bit careless. Like, I think, obviously, like, he's probably been out in Amsterdam. I'm getting the impression he probably has, like, because European gun laws are a lot stricter.
What?
Like,
what? You just don't willy-nilly it?
And I imagine he's not kind of just, like, even though he's a criminal, he's not kind of, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not as open. And there's that, like, the fact that they have survived what they've survived. You got to imagine, like, even if you do this all the time, there's got to be some, like, especially in that, because it is such a freak occurrence that, like, it's just adrenaline, and the way the scene's played as well, they're kind of both pumped, for their different reasons. Like, Jules is kind of pumped, like, he thinks it's divine intervention. And, like, Vince is just pumped because he's like, fuck, I could have literally been back a week and I could have died because Jerry Seinfeld's got a hand cannon. Do you know what I mean? Like,
do we think maybe it's because he might jones in for some heroin as this day goes on, as this morning goes on? Because he starts to get more and more erratic in his behavior at that moment, from that moment on.
It's that he's probably like, he really needs a shit. He's probably like, you got to imagine he's probably jet lagged as well. Like, he's like four or five days into being like back from Amsterdam. Like, his body's probably a bit out of whack. Like, yeah, I just think it's complacency more so than an intentional like thing. I just think, because how surprised he is afterwards. Do you know what I mean?
He is surprised.
Like,
yes, he is very surprised. It's, like, it's what makes us just comedic genius. Like, even when I saw it for the first time, I had a feeling he was going, like, the gun was going off. Like, I just, like, the way he sets down the seat, he talks and turns around, like, I think he's going to shoot him. But I didn't expect the reaction, the gore, the stuff. Like, if you watch it again, if you just go to the scene, not only is Travolta's reaction fantastic, but watch Sam's reaction. His reaction's fucking spectacular. Gets me laughing every time. I only watch Sam's reaction now because he's the one who knows that it's coming. Like, he knows, they both know it's coming because obviously they know the gag's coming. But his reaction is spectacular, almost as if he didn't know it was coming. Or how much shit was going to be thrown at him from behind that back seat when it happens. Now, what do you think his big dick standoff with Mr. Wolf is? What do you think that's about?
Again, I think, like, because he is probably held in such high regard with Marcellus Wallace, and then, like, he's probably not used to, I don't know, because he probably is normally in charge of situations, do you know what I mean?
I was thinking he was running shit over in Amsterdam for a while.
Yeah, it's probably, like, a thing of, like, getting used to the fact that he's coming back here and he's answering to people, do you know what I mean? He's, like you said, a mixture of things. He's jonesing in for some heroin. He's obviously like, and what is it that happens? If you fuck up a situation, like, a lot of people then get on the defensive, right? Like, yeah. So it's probably an element of that where he's like, oh, fuck you. Like, you're coming in telling us, like, he's already been told off by Jules for, like, washing his hands, like, not washing them properly. So, yeah, I think there's an element of that as well. I just think it's kind of Vince, I don't, showing us that, like, he is just a bit of a fuck up as well.
I clearly don't think he knows of Mr. Wolf and his reputation. I think Jules knows of him. I think maybe he's heard a little bit about him, but clearly Jules, from his reaction, oh, you're sending the Wolf? You know, I mean, like, he feels very calm now that the Wolf is coming. He's like, oh, we're going to get out of the situation. And I don't know that Vincent is as up to date, maybe, or has had a face-to-face interaction with Mr. Wolf. Because he eventually learns to appreciate him when they have their diner talk. But in the moment, like, he's almost, like you said, it does feel like he's just like, my dick's bigger than yours, motherfucker. You know, do you know who I am? I'm Vincent Vega. Ask Marcellus about me. You know what I mean? But
yeah, because I get the impression that Winston Wolf is like a subcontractor. He's not he doesn't just work for Marcellus Wallace. He is just kind of, he's almost like the LA fixer. Do you know what I mean? Like, just kind of, He will sort out any shit for any kind of, like, monster. Yeah,
that's how he answers it. I'm Winston Wolf. I solve problems. It's like, problem solvers.
I'm not sure if you're going to be... Are you doing an episode on Winston Wolf?
We are doing an episode of Mr. Wolf. Absolutely.
Oh. Well,
absolutely. You have to. One of the great side characters... I mean, this movie's full of them, but two of the greatest side characters are Winston Wolf and obviously Captain Coons, and those both are having their own episodes.
For a bit of research for you, please watch all of the direct line adverts.
Yes, we will. I know, you fuckers. You always get the good stuff. It's not even your shit and you get the good stuff. Yes, I know. Mr. Wolf has another life outside of fucking Pulp Fiction. Son of a bitch.
Harvey Keitel just wanted that cash.
Now, another moment is the diner scene. Pumpkin and Honey Bunny are lucky that he had to take a shit. If he didn't go up to go try to take a shit, they're dead. Jules is in a transitional period, as he says. Uh-huh. We'll discuss that next month. Vincent's not a transitional period. Vincent's constipated. He needs some heroin. He's all jacked up on the shit that he's had to do today. And he's ready to kill a couple fucking motherfuckers. And I'm like, Jules, I'm going to shoot him just on principle. You give that numbnut any money. Like I said, in this film, unfortunately, for fucking Vincent Vega, his arc goes in reverse. He starts to be like, oh, okay, we meet Vincent, and he's kind of a little guy, and the whole thing with Mia, and we're like, oh, poor guy, we wish they could get together. And as the movie goes further, you're like, what a fucking ass clown. This guy's a fucking moron. He fucked all this shit up, but he continually fucks up as we go. And, you know, I mean, that whole scene in, you know, cleaning the car, can't fucking wash his hands properly. Well, maybe they had some lava. It's just, it's excuse after excuse, is not his fault. It's just fucking insanity. But his, unfortunately, his arc, if it's linearly, he starts this way and then eventually gets a better arc. He becomes a lovable guy that we're all kind of upset that dies at the end. But what this, in this version, you're like, he deserved his death. He was such a fucking dick. What a douchebag he really he is in this version. It's such a terrible arc for him. But the diner scene, he would have fucking lit them both up. Why 100%. Do you think he doesn't come out shooting? Why do you think? I mean, he had the drop on Yolanda. Yolanda did not know he was there until all of a sudden he was there. He could have walked out and shot her off the counter, and that was that, because game's over. The standoff ends right then and there, because Ringo's got nothing. Yolanda's fucking gone, and that's that. And now at this point, Jules is kind of put in a tight spot. Why leave a witness? Why leave another person? They're going to execute him too.
I think because he can hear, probably like from the toilet, like as he's coming out, he can hear Jules is handling the situation. Do you know what I mean? I'm back in town. So far, obviously, we've seen their dynamic that, mm-hmm. like,
yeah, that Jules does run the show when they go to that section of a job.
Yeah, and it's like he is the kind of strong, silent type, and he will kind of like, he is the one to worry about. The fact that, like, even Jules has to say, like, we're all going to be cool, right, Vince? Like, he always like says it to Vince as well. Like, yeah, even you're going to be cool, right? And like, so I think it's that. I think it's like he, as much as like he can fuck up a situation, like, he will fall in line if he can hear that, like, Jules is already handling it. And, like, and I think it just, yeah, it makes for, it just makes it more impactful, right? The mm-hmm. fact that he said, like, just the camera turns around and he's just fucking there. Like,
yeah,
this is some cool shit.
I think we knew as the viewer he was eventually going to show. We just didn't know how he was going to show up.
Yeah.
And maybe it is better that he just shows up pointing the gun as opposed to coming out blasting. Let's be honest. In the hands of a lesser writer-director, he comes out shooting. And we don't get the great ending with Jules being able to have that speech and recognizing and reconciling with himself of who he really is as opposed to who he thinks he is. We get bang, bang, and we move on. We never get that moment. We just have a, oh, yeah, they're dead. Like, if it's an action film, they're both dead in a second. And it's
there's like a shootout and like one Vince or Jules gets clipped, but like it's not fatal and stuff like that. And like, whereas this feels like, as much as it is kind of like, this world that Tarantino's created is like kind of like the real world turned up like, I don't know, 20%. Do you know what I mean? So it feels a lot more, it feels quite grounded in that sense, like that there isn't like, and these are professionals, do you know what I mean? They're kind of like guys who, obviously they are probably acutely aware that like they can get away with this shit if it doesn't end in a shootout with all these fucking witnesses. Do you know what I mean? They can kind of like, these people will be like, these dudes are clearly bad motherfuckers, but this day they essentially saved our lives. So we're gonna turn a blind eye to this. Whereas like, if it ends in a shootout, they've kind of got nowhere to turn.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And not only that, it also shows that we've got people who are aware of their surroundings and the ramifications of their actions, which you don't always get in movies. It's usually shoot first, ask questions later. Like, I like that we are grounding this in somewhat reality, where Vincent, even though we don't know, because, you know, he's all over the place in this film, and a lot of it could be the heroin, a lot of it could be a lot of things going on for Vincent. He's like a fish out of water when he returns. Like, he's trying to reacclimate himself to this life back in America and the whole thing he's doing. And he could have shot them, but he also realizes that he saw what Jules was able to do. If Jules has got this, Jules has got this. And probably when he came out, he saw Jules got the gun on him. I'm just going to make sure that we've covered my this ass, that if she decides to get squirrel and shoots him, I'm taking them both right now anyway. So at least, I guess, as Mr. Wolf said, he kept his spurs from jingling and jangling.
Well, yeah, I think it's that thing as well, is like, they know the protocol is like, you try, like, I imagine they probably didn't want to shoot all those guys in that room, but like obviously they've done fucked up. Do you know what I mean? Like if it was just a clear exchange, they probably would have gone in with the guns, like used a bit of muscle. But if they hadn't have fucked Marcellus Wallace, like, they wouldn't have executed them.
Yeah.
Like so, I think like their kind of protocol and their probably like rules that they live by is like we are hitmen, but at the same time we're like if we've got a job that can just involves a bit of intimidation and getting done what needs to be done, like shooting should be the last, do you know what I mean, like the last point of recourse. Yeah, and it just makes it for a lot more interesting, right? Like, and that's what makes this film great, is like the big showdown at the end of this film is a battle of words and wits.
Yes.
And like a great speech, as opposed to like, I don't think this film would be talked about as much as it is. Like the violence in it is kind of sparing and like impactful, whereas like if there was a big shootout at the end of this, you'd be like, oh, I've seen this tons of times before. Do you know what I mean? Like,
man, it ends with two people realizing that they need to make a change in their life.
Yeah.
Two criminals who now realize they need to make a change in their life. And I'm not talking about Vince, I'm talking about Pumpkin and his girlfriend, and obviously Sam's character in Julie.
Yeah, like Ringo joins the police force and infiltrates a gang doing a diamond heist. Like, he really sorts himself out.
Pretty crazy how quickly he does that. And he loses the accent and everything. It's crazy. Lastly, before I get into our diagnosis, the date with Mia, if she had not OD'd, and I still believe he jerked off, she's the one who got away from him, obviously. The kiss being blown at the end, and then the way he's very cold with her, and they pretend like nothing's happened when he sees her again a couple of days later. She's, oh, I never thanked you for dinner. Like, almost as if it was just like a happenstance. The two of them, in Mia's mind, the two of them were having sex. She just needed a little bit more liquid courage, and it was going to fucking happen. And Vincent had to walk into the bathroom to pause himself and maybe get one out the chamber to keep himself alive. What do you think would have happened if she had no D? Do we think that him and Mia would have... Or do you think he would... The way he came out was the way he was going to come out anyways, regardless, and that was going to be it?
100%. I think for him, like... Do you know what I mean? Like, the fact that he's the one saying, like, even a foot massage is enough to get a man... Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's unreasonable, but, like, there was going to be some consequences for those... For doing that. So, like... Yeah, I think he knew that, like, I've got to, like, as much as this kind of is, like, I imagine, like, yeah, like, the sexual chemistry that would be developed from, like, two people dancing really, like, well with each other, like, that is enough to be like, fucking hell, do you know what I mean? He's probably, like, all charged up from that, and, like, she's been vulnerable with him, she's kind of got him to be vulnerable with her. Yeah, I think her ODing is possibly the best thing that happened to him in a way, like, because yeah, he could have, I don't think he would have, but I think her ODing really just puts the kibosh on them fucking, so
yeah.
But yeah, I really don't think he would have, like, it kind of, it would make no sense if he's kind of gone to Amsterdam for 3 years for Marcellus Wallace,
yeah,
to then just fuck it up within the first week.
He even defends Marcellus for throwing Tony Rockefeller off the building, if that was exactly what happened.
Yeah.
The one thing we do learn about Vince, of everything else, if there's one gleaming, shining moment we can point to Vince for being, he's loyal. The man was loyal. And Marcellus Wallace put his faith in the right fucking guy. Because now Marcellus would be upset with probably the events that happened. However, out of somewhat Vincent's control. But Vince did what he had to do to make sure he didn't fuck her. And to make sure she got home alive. And that is all he needed to do. And unfortunately, if he learned not to do heroin, he wouldn't be taking a shit in that house. And as soon as that door opened, bang, bang. Butch is dead. And he's a hero again.
And we don't know as well, like... if obviously it's Marcellus Wallace, like, testing Vince as well, like, kind of knowing, like...
I guess it could be, yeah.
His wife is quite promiscuous. Do you know what I mean? Like, again, we don't know what happened in Amsterdam, whether, like, Vince maybe did, like, some shit there. And it's like, well, this guy's back. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, obviously, as you said, like, speaking to people probably wasn't as easy as it is today. So it's like... this guy's been gone for 3 years, I can do this little test to kind of test his loyalty now he's back. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is it, The Sopranos with, is it Big Pussy?
Yeah. Where,
like, do you know what I mean? Like, he disappears for a while and then everyone's like suspicious that he's the rat and stuff like that. And then it's like, You don't know. You don't know in this, like, in this situation. Like, it could be Marcellus Wallace being like, I like Vince. He's a good guy. Like, obviously, I respect him, but these guys have got to be tested sometimes. Like,
you're not wrong. You're not freaking wrong on that. And he comes out on top. He just does. He was able to avoid the honeypot. He comes out on top. He is the man that can be trusted. And the one thing it does say, both Vega brothers, they may be some serious fuck-ups in certain areas, may be quick to violence, but they're loyal. They are fucking loyal. Maybe to a fault, but they both were loyal. One did time, one got killed. They both got killed, but they both were loyal and they passed the test.
What's her name again?
Mia.
Mia.
Why are you so interested in Big Man's wife?
Well, he's going out of town in Florida, and he asked me if I'd take care of her while he's gone.
Take care?
No, man. Just take her out, you know. Show her a good time, make sure she don't get lonely.
You're going to be taking Mia Wallace out on a date?
It's not a date. You know, it's just, it's like if you were going to take your buddy's wife to a movie or something. It's just good company, that's all. It's not a date. It's definitely not a date.
That brings us to our clinical diagnosis of Vincent Vega.
And now, the AI clinical diagnosis.
And once again, I turned to AI and asked it to clinically diagnose Vincent based on the psychological evaluation it had performed on him earlier. So without further ado, here is Vincent Vega's clinical diagnosis. He has been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, classified as ICD-10. And here's the criteria for the diagnosis. Callous, unconcerned for the feeling of others. Gross and persistent attitude of irresponsibility and disregard for social norms, rules, and obligations. Incapacity to maintain enduring relationships, though having no difficulty in establishing them. Very low tolerance to frustration and a low threshold for discharge of aggression, including violence. Incapacity to experience guilt or to profit from experience, particularly punishment. Marked readiness to blame others or to offer plausible rationalizations for behavior that has brought the person into conflict with society. In summary, Vincent Vega's behaviors and attitudes are consistent with the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder. Specifically, he demonstrates a lack of empathy, irresponsible impulsivity, disregard for laws, arrogance, and hostility towards others, and an inability to form meaningful relationships. His work as a contract killer evinces his callous lack of concern for human life and social norms. Vega's numerous risk-taking behaviors illustrate poor judgment and impulsivity. He also refuses to accept responsibility for the consequences of his action. The constellation of personality traits and behaviors conforms to the definition of antisocial personality disorder in the ICD-10 classification system. That saved me a whole bunch of money. Thank you, AI, for not having that. So, yeah, I mean, again, I'm not a clinical psychologist. And if there's one out there who does listen to the show and you'd like to chime in and tell us your thoughts on these and don't want to charge me, please feel free to reach out to us on our socials. But there you go. Mr. Vincent Vega has been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's, most likely. But, like, he is... Yeah, I don't know. I think
look, it does all of us are diagnosed with something, and we just don't want to know it. We're just doing it for him. So it doesn't say anything about you if you like the man, because I also like the man, and I also like Jules, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he's diagnosed with next month.
Delusions of grandeur.
Exactly.
So I hear you taking Mia out tomorrow.
At Marcellus's request.
Have you met Mia?
Not yet. So fucking funny. What a goddamn thing.
I got to piss.
Look, I'm not a fucking idiot, all right? It's a big man's wife. I'm gonna sit across from her, chew my food with my mouth closed, laugh at her fucking jokes, and that's it.
Hey, my name's Paul, and this shit's between y'all.
What would you fucking ask me about it for? A pack of red apples.
Filters?
None. You looking at something, friend? He ain't my friend, Palooka.
What's that?
I think you heard me just fine, Punchy.
Now let's talk about Mr. Travolta's portrayal of Vincent Vega. But before we get into him, let's talk about who was considered for the role. This role was originally written for Michael Madsen. If Mattson had played the character, then we can infer that they would have been twins. That was what maybe Tarantino was going to be going for, is that Vincent and Vic were twins, had Michael Mattson been in the role. John was the strong second choice. Others mentioned Alec Baldwin, Gary Oldman, William Peterson, Andy Garcia, Michael Keaton, Denzel Washington, Dennis Quaid, Robert Carradine, and Aidan Quinn. The strong third choices were Alec Baldwin, Gary Oldman, and Michael Keaton were the ones to fall in line next below John Travolta. Pretty interesting list of people. Had Denzel been the character, Vincent Vega and Vic Vega are not brothers. That just, there's a biological thing there that says that they're not brothers unless they're stepbrothers. Yep. So that would have changed things. Denzel and Sam is a boof. What a pairing that would have been on screen.
Have we ever seen that on screen?
I don't think we have. That I could,
I think the world would end if that
happens.
It would.
It's too much testosterone, too much motherfucker. It's just too much. It's just
too much swagger.
The world would I do know that this is poor phrasing, but it's what it is. The world would turn into a black hole and would fold in on itself.
Yeah.
So what happened? It's not my fault that the name of the term is black hole. Like, I'm not trying to say because two black men makes black hole. These two gentlemen.
Their charisma sucks the world inward. Their charisma would like rip a hole in time and space, like as we know it, I reckon. Like, there'd just be 100%. Too much charisma.
Too much. It's too much big dick energy going on in that scene. I mean, first of all, there's no way Denzel's playing some cool-headed character standing in the back not saying anything. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, we just yelled that guy to death. He wouldn't even shot him. His head would have exploded. So there we have our characters. Who would you have liked to have seen if it wasn't John of that list? And I would not have liked to see Michael Mattson do it, although I love Michael Mattson. He's Vic. I don't want to see him playing some weird Nicolas Cage dual brothers from a film.
I think of that list, just because I think he hasn't had a big enough career in like making movies, and I wish he kind of wasn't kind of gobbled up in CSI.
I already knew you were going to say too. I had an
William
idea.
Peterson.
Which is interesting because he does get to direct him in that final season 2 arc episode of CSI. Like, I forget what season number it is, but it's one of the better CSIs that they've ever made. It's like one of the highest.
And I think that is his reason why he did that. He wanted to work with William Peterson. Because I imagine like a big film, like whether he's ever said it or not for Tarantino, especially like his kind of fascination with LA crime is To Live and Die in LA. And like William Peterson, like obviously plays like almost like a prototypical Tarantino character because he's a cop, but he's very like he plays in the shades of gray, and that film is kind of like prototypical, like like Tarantino, like is kind of like do you know what I mean it is it's the LA crime thing. It's like you're introduced to the good guys and the bad guys, and you're like, I watched that movie and I'm like, I actually side with Willem Dafoe's character for a lot of this. He probably he's got more of a moral code than like William Peterson. And I think, and it would have had that great, it would have had that other, like, it would have been another giving an actor like a career boost. Yeah. I think if he had done that for William Peterson, like he's the one I think would have benefited the most from it. And I think would have like, it would have been great to see, because he kind of, if you see him, like he has that great nervy energy that I think would lend itself to Vincent. I think it would have been slightly different. Like, I think he would have like played a more nervy heroin guy than like, because Travolta plays it just so cool. Like, I think William Peterson of all those people, because I really like him as an actor.
It's always hard to say who could have done the job better. I don't know that anyone could have done better than John, because
I don't think anyone could have done it better. I just think
It would have been cool. Yeah. You know, in some alternate universe that it hasn't been ripped apart by Denzel and Sam Jackson and screen together, maybe William Peterson did get the role and he is Vincent Vega somewhere.
And I think he would have been on that list because Tarantino likes To Live and Die in LA, and probably Manhunter.
And probably Manhunter as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he's probably like those two movies, like, that guy's fucking great. Like,
yeah. Now, John Travolta got the role. And for those who don't know, and if you don't, then maybe you lived under a rock or maybe just some research, but to prepare for the role, of a heroin-loving hitman, since Travolta is not a drug user. That his claims, I don't know. I've never been around Travolta to know. But he sought the advice of one of Tarantino's friends, which is not surprising, that Tarantino had a friend who was a recovering drug addict. Tarantino's buddy explained to John that if he wanted to get an idea of what it was like to be on heroin, he should get wasted on tequila and lay in warm water. That would give him a brief idea of what it was like to start to slip into being high on heroin. So, John Travolta, the rich man that he is, he and his wife Kelly, who has since passed, lined up shots of tequila along a pool, got drunk off their asses, and then sat in a hotel hot tub to get themselves ready, to get himself kind of ready to see what it was like. Now, what he does when he is pretending to be on heroin, I've always said that this is Tarantino's first love-making scene. He is making love to heroin in that moment. And Travolta may not have ever done heroin, but Jesus Christ, I'm going to tell you what. If you didn't already have that information, some of you might think, I know I did. I was like, John may have at one time chased the horse. I don't know. He seems like he may have been on the H train for a little bit. He is spectacular with nuances. The way he leaves Lance's is high. And the way he, and again, folks, this is filmed over different days. It's weird because sometimes you sit there and you watch a movie and you forget that this is filmed over a series of days and they may be separate days. They may have filmed all the car stuff with Lance first. It's always out of sequence. So you don't know when they filmed it. But to watch the film put together, to watch him go from high on heroin, enjoying the ride over, to being not even like the confused Travolta meme that we now have because of it, which is spectacular, to him sitting at dinner, like he almost gets lost. He walks past the car. He's sitting there. He's rolling a cigarette. He's kind of like out of it. And then he slowly comes to, and then he dances. And all these mannerisms that he's able to encapsulate and not do on heroin, this is why he should have won the Academy Award. Like, that scene, that whole moment of Mia Wallace and Vincent Vega is spectacular. He's unbelievable, man. He totally sells that he is on fucking heroin. I don't know how you feel about it, but it's one of those great performances where it's so nuanced and it's so, I think, overlooked because of everything else that goes on in the film that people just bypass the fact that this man pretends to be on heroin and you can't tell that he's not. And again, these scenes are shot over different times and different takes. It's seamless. His transfer in.
It's the uses of like those insert shots, I think, are great. You know, like we get like the kind of unzipping of the bag.
Yes.
Like the needle and pulling going it in out. The skin. Yeah.
Goes
yeah,
in
yeah.
his arm. Yeah. Oh, it's so beautifully shot.
It's like very, like you said, it's almost like done lovingly and like sexually. And then,
oh,
like,
absolutely.
Utilizing like old Hollywood techniques. Obviously, they could have filmed John Travolta out actually in a car, but you can tell it's like rear projections and stuff like that. And it kind of, without kind of going like overly like, oh, it's kind of washed out and like, do you know what I mean? Putting an effect on there or doing anything thingy. It's kind of just the use of, yeah, like old Hollywood techniques to kind of get that kind of spacey washed out thing of just like, you're in the headspace. And yeah, like Travolta, just like, I don't, just like the face and stuff like that. It's like, you get that sense of what, like, how he's feeling.
Full disclosure, he makes using heroin look fucking fantastic in that moment, right? Like, this is why I think he's also a functioning heroin addict, is he knows the right amount to give him the high that he needs. Because, again, anyone who is a fan of Breaking Bad, and I'm a huge fan, is it season two, I believe, when Jesse gets the girlfriend and they get hooked on heroin. They take it and they go out. Like, they go into the sleep, into the heroin, pass out, they're out. John has found that level. His character has found the level where he can get just the right amount of high.
Yeah, but we don't know
still
how
stay
long
lucid.
He's...
No, but you know what I'm saying? Like he's a functioning heroin addict because he's able to do it and continue to move forward.
But I think like, because it's daytime when he's at Lance's, I think there is
it is nighttime when he's driving.
There's a couple of hours, I think, that are left out where he's probably just like zonked out and like maybe like just chatting shit to Trudy. Do you know what I mean?
Like, was that? That's the one with all the shit in their face?
It doesn't go full like train spotting with it. Like,
no, yeah, no one's diving into a shitty toilet in Scotland, that's for sure. No one's,
yeah, he's not planning. He's not seeing babies crawling on the ceiling just yet. Like,
yeah, but what John does in this film is spectacular. It is, in my opinion, and I'm gonna ask you in a second, it is, in my opinion, and he's done some great work. I don't want to take anything away from him, but in my opinion, this is his best. And what I love is I came into it similar to you. I knew John Travolta as the guy from Grease, the guy from Saturday Night Live, and also Welcome Back, Kotosh. You know him? He's the guy who dances all the fucking time, and then he's the fucking airplane guy, and Bruce Willis is his baby, voices of his baby, and you're like, oh, things aren't going so well for John. And so you know him as from all these early stuff. So when she says, we're going to dance, I remember having the same reaction that Vincent Vega has, which is like, no, please, we don't need a movie. Why is he dancing again? Yeah, and you don't realize that what a great setup it is, because Tarantino knows, those of us who go into this movie back then, knowing the lineage of John Travolta, going, really, he's going to dance? And even him being like, no. We all had the same reaction at the same time. Yeah. So when he gets up there and he's like, fuck. You know, it's like if I don't dance, I'm dead. Like, it's if I don't do this, I don't do what Mia wants, I'm in trouble.
She's like a bratty kid, right?
Yes.
Like, I want to win that trophy.
She's Veruca Salt. I want the trophy. Yeah. We're going to dance. Let's fucking go. And he gets up there. And just the way he dances, where it's like he's concentrating on being a good dancer, but he's not doing his old dances that we know him to do. You know, like, he's like, you know what I mean? He's not doing the shooters. You know, he's not doing Grease, go Grease Latin. He's not doing any of that. It worked. And he just sells it. And he's so fucking good in this film. I just absolutely love him in this movie. And it's a great feather for him to have in his cap. It's something to take with him for the rest of his fucking life. Whether he's done anything good since doesn't matter, honestly. He doesn't get some of your favorite movies. He doesn't get to get into Face Off and some of these other movies without this film. Mm-hmm. But for me, this is his best role he's ever done. It's his most iconic role. It shows his acting chops that no one knew he had. And unfortunately, I don't know that a lot of people have given him the opportunity to show that he's more than meets the eye.
Well, I think this is a close second for me. I think like his best performance is as Jack Terry in Blowout.
In Blowout, okay. Very fair. I had a feeling it might be a pick.
Yeah, just because, I don't know, like, there is something, like, he plays like a vulnerability and like still manages to be like uber cool in that film. And it is that thing that, like, without that film, this film doesn't, like, he's not cast.
It's the chicken, like, and the egg, right?
Yeah. It's like without that kind of, because I've got the Arrow Blu-ray of Blowout, and like there's an interview between, like, just written, but it's Tarantino and De Palma talking about Blowout. And, like, obviously, he's very vocal about that being one of his favourite films. And I think that is the film, like, this is like now it's like a mid-career kind of high point.
Yeah.
But that is just kind of, like, what a turn from, like, do you know what I mean, being Saturday Night Fever, Grease, to then do something like Blowout, which is, like, a really dark film. And, like, he's like, do you know what I mean? He plays vulnerable, he plays cool, but then, like, he has to play darkness. Like, it's got one of the best kind of, like, final shots of a film, like his kind of, like, acting in that that final moment of Blowout. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but just, like, what he does with his face and the kind of, like, the physicality of him in that film as well, like, when he's kind of, like, running around his production studio when he thinks, like the tapes and stuff like that. It's just, like, it encapsulates everything. He is moving like a dancer without actually dancing in that movie. And, like, that's what I think so great about it. But yeah, this is, like, very much just, like, do you know what I mean? If anything, like, Blowout is 1A and this is 1B for me. Like, it's kind of like they are the high point, I think, of, like, John Travolta. And then, like, as much as we kind of can laugh at Saturday Night Fever, it's a fucking great performance. Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely. Like,
to play that, like, kind of dumb, like, knowing that that's like, do you know what I mean? I think that for years people thought John Travolta was that guy. And, like, that, what a great performance.
Oh, because he also played Horseshack. Not Horseshack, but Vinnie Barbarino on fucking Welcome Back, Kotosh. So he's similar. So, I mean, he was typecast for a little bit. He was typecast for a little bit.
Let's ask our guest some fucking questions.
All right, my friend, let's close out our character study with your final questions. And our first one being...
Number one.
What was your favorite line of dialogue spoken by Vincent Vega?
It's kind of too many to pick from, right? He's just kind of, like, has so many, like, little quips and stuff like that. And just, like... just the way he delivers, like, small lines, do you know what I mean? Like, like you said, like, the whole thing, like, he's like, oh, who's that woman with, like, the shit in her face and stuff like that? Or, like, the exchanges between him and Lance with, like...
King's car.
Yeah, or, like, when Mia Wallace is, like, going to OD and stuff like that. Like, Do you know what I mean? And they're kind of like the bickering back and forth of like who's gonna inject her and stuff like that. He's like, I've never done this, man.
Like, what would you pick if a gun to your head? What would be the one? If someone said this, the only one can go in to the Hall of Fame. What's his Hall of Fame line for you?
Oh fuck! It was. Do you know what? I should have written it down because I was like, it's probably gonna be. It's one from the early. From like his first time you see him, because I think it's the first line where you just go like, I kind of love this guy. It's when he says about the mayonnaise and Jules says, God damn. And he's like, I've seen him do it, man. They fucking drown him in that shit.
I fucking hate mayonnaise. I fucking love that line.
Yeah, it's just like the kind of like the delivery of that line. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen him do it, man. They fucking drown him in that shit.
That's a good choice. I mean, like you said, there's a lot of good ones. At Pulp Fiction, this is a tough one. There's so many quotable lines.
Number two.
Now, what was your favorite moment or scene involving the late, great Mr. Vincent Vega? May he rest in peace.
Well, it's very difficult because, like, they kind of, once the ball gets rolling, do you know what? I think it is all the stuff at Jackrabbit Slim's, just because you kind of got the production,
yeah,
like the set and stuff like that, doing like some great stuff. Like, just it is a scene where we get the vulnerability of like, and just like the kind of like exchanges about like, so you're telling me that's it's a shake that costs $5, like, and it, like him like trying it and like culminating in the dancing, like that whole scene, it's just great. And kind of like, yeah, watching John Travolta rolling cigarettes as well, I get a real I don't know why, I get a real kick out of that. He looks so fucking like so deep in like concentration. You kind of get the feeling he's never rolled a cigarette before.
He's also high on heroin at the same time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's still trying to look cool, but he's like, man, I should not be this high right now. I'm still not all the way down.
Yeah, so I think like kind of as a scene, it's got to be Jackrabbit Slim's.
Number three.
Now, where does this character rank for you in the pantheon of Tarantino characters?
Quite high for me, because I think this, I'm trying to think if this was the first. It's very difficult for me to like remember if I saw this or Reservoir Dogs first. I saw them very quickly together. Like, because obviously I was, yeah, when these movies came out, I was way too young. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think this movie came out, I was like 3 years old. So I would have seen this. I've got to say, like, he's top five. And like, my top five is probably very interchangeable on a day-to-day basis. But like, he was the first character. Him and Jules were like the first characters from a Tarantino movie where I was like, this is what a Tarantino movie is. Do you know what I mean? They kind of like embodied what that was. So yeah, I think let's just say number two, like, because there are characters, yeah, it's probably someone like Aldo Raine or Archie Hickox for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like my number one, just because I love Inglourious Basterds. I like Hans Lander, just because like Christoph Waltz is amazing in that. So yeah, I would say two, maybe three.
Number four.
So I have one I just came up with that I'm throwing in, and I think this would be a great way to close it out. If you had to write his dating bio, what would you say on it? What would be his little quick blurb dating bio on any one of the dating sites out there? How would you describe Mr. Vincent Vega so that the ladies or the gents, whomever, would fall for Mr. Vincent Vega?
I think he would write, I enjoy like late night drives, dancing, spontaneous activities.
The occasional shit.
He would allude, reading. He'd be like, I like to read. I think he would kind of like allude to the fact, like, do you know what I mean? He's very much hiding the fact he takes heroin and he kills people. I think he's kind of like saying all of the plus points of him, like, yeah, I'll take you, let's go dancing, like I'm into that. Like, I think if he had survived this, he would have kind of had like a new reawakening. And I think he's kind of, he's closing it off, he's using a couple of emojis, he's doing like a blowing kiss emoji, I think, at the end, like of his dating bio. I think he's got one photo with the hair up, he's got another one with the hair down. For some reason, every photo he's in a black suit. Like, people are like, who's this guy? Like, does he go to a lot of funerals? Like, I'm not really quite sure. What, like,
when the hair's down, it's a tie. When the hair's up, it's the bolo. He just using.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's got that duster jacket on, like.
Quentin set me up with an interview with, they called it Chippy, a weekend heroin addict. And then I found on my own a daily ex-heroin addict, and I took copious notes about how they behaved when they're on the good stuff and when they're on the bad stuff and all the differences. And I came to a happy medium about the behavior that he would have. And then finally I said, okay, these notes are wonderful, but how do I execute it without getting a taste of what this is like? So finally I said to the ex-weekend chipper, I said, what do I do? Because I'm not going to do heroin, so what can I do to actually feel something? He said, well, okay, if you have to, get plastered on a bunch of tequila and lay in a warm pool of water. And he said, and then you'll be at the bottom of the feeling that you start to feel when you're on heroin. And I said, well, I could do that. So I ordered
Good Friday night.
A bunch of shots of it and did it, and I went, ah, okay. And then the notes, I could apply all those notes that I had from both drug addicts, I could apply to that feeling and exaggerate it when needed, because they describe beautifully the arc of a heroin high, beautifully. So I, whether Quentin knew it or not, but he built in beautifully the arc, and he didn't, I don't even know if he knew that he had, but from the time he shoots up to the time he picks up Mia, to the time he goes to the restaurant, to the time the shocking overdose happens, right. That's when, by that time in any of that evening, he would have started to come down.
Yeah.
So that sober thing that happened to him when the needle is shot is probably the point where that heroin started to. And so it worked beautifully for me. But I remember Quentin even saying, I don't know exactly what John's doing. You know, he's shuffling slowly and he's moving. He's talking slowly and he's looking around. But that was my playing the arc of the heroin.
And that's a wrap on our first edition of Character Study. I would once again like to thank my special guest, Mr. Petros Patsilvas, host of the Cajun Coppola Connections podcast and co-host of the Getting to Foia podcast, for joining me today. I had an absolute blast discussing the intricacies of what makes Vincent Vega tick. Now, you can find the links to all of Petros' endeavors and their socials in our show notes. And as always, you can become a member of the Church of Tarantino by following us on all our socials. Those links can be found in the show notes as well. Now, if you'd be so kind and take a moment to like, review, subscribe, and follow us, the Church would greatly appreciate it, as it will help other Tarantino fans like yourself find the show. So be sure to join me again next week as Sean Wheeler, owner of Scareflow Records and newly ordained officer here at the Church, joins me as my permanent co-host as we kick off our new Inglourious Blue Wall series, where each month we take a look at one of the many projects Mr. Tarantino has announced over his illustrious 30-plus year career that never came to fruition, and the level of blue balls it has left us with. First up, his original declaration, the Vega Brothers, a.k.a. Double V Vega. So until then, I'm the Reverend Scott K. May Tarantino be with you always.
This has been a Man with an Exceptional Beard production.